This is episode 13 of Don't Be a Scrub podcast. My name is Spider Carnage, aka Verbose Mute on Xbox Live. My interviewing partner is Mutton, aka Muttonhead01 on Xbox Live and PSN. We've been away for quite a while. This was due to a number of interesting and I suppose random occurrences happening. I moved house. Both Mutton and I are now working full time. It's been getting harder and harder to also organize ourselves to do interviews and whatnot. Plus, with all the preparations of Shadaloo Showdown coming up, we've sort of been, in a sort of way, Mutton's been running Chris's Clubhouse Fallout, and I've been sort of doing the Deacon thing on the side, but anyway, this time around, we actually have a monster of an episode. This episode actually has broken the all-time length of the show. It now clocks in at 2 hours and 4 minutes, breaking the previous record holder of Heavy Weapons of an hour and 28. To tell you the truth, I think the only time we actually really stopped, and the only reason why we did actually stop the recording was because my recorder was actually running out of batteries. We could have just kept on going. One other thing I need to mention before we get on with the interview is that we will no longer be doing transcripts of the podcast. And the reason for this is, I'll just give you an example. An hour worth of content in audio form takes Mutton approximately about five days to actually transcribe and put up on his page. Again, an hour of content transcribes to around 50 pages in just your standard Microsoft Office document, which is actually quite a lot and it's quite time consuming. And like I said, that Mutton is working full time. He doesn't have as much time to actually just sit around and transcribe. So we're going to be moving to an audio only podcast. You can still also always find the link on Mutton's blog. And yeah. That's pretty much it. So we hope you enjoyed the interview.
This is Salty from Shadaloo.com and you're listening to Don't Be a Scrub podcast. Stay salty, Australia.
Okay, so today we are at Deakin University for the special LA Revelations stream that we did both Saturday, Sunday night for Toxie being in LA for the tournament, which we thought was quite good. Had a lot of interesting people turn up.
Yep.
And one of those interesting people is one of Melbourne's top players, easily top players. Who's been around for quite a long time. And, of course, we are talking about Akira.
Akira. So, hi, Akira. How are you doing today?
I'm good, thank you. I'm a bit nervous.
So, Akira, I mean, you're kind of like this hidden dragon in the Melbourne scene. Like, you don't enter too many tournaments. Like, can you tell us why you don't enter console tournaments?
Because, first of all, I'm an arcade bred. So, I don't really like console. And I don't even have console. I never practice console at home. So I just don't see any point in me entering the tournament. Because when I enter the tournament, I prepare. Without preparation, tournament is not a tournament. It's not a place to compete. So to me, if I don't have a preparation, I won't enter.
I see what you mean. So, I mean, what do you actually do like when you prepare for a tournament, arcade tournament?
I do a lot of thinking. Say, on wake up, what can this character do? And what are the options I have? And on top of that, I try to sort of predict the likelihood of particular moves that the particular player is, you know? How do I put it? It's like I prepare character strategy first, and then I try to find a
abusable strategy?
No, like say a person has a particular habit I can take advantage of.
I see.
I'll look for that.
So a weakness, basically.
Yeah. I usually try to tell them, but sometimes they don't listen.
Okay.
Sometimes they think that I'm a smart ass.
Mm-hmm.
And I take no offense to that, but I mean, I've always wanted the community to sort of grow. That's my preparation. I sort of look at the character and look at the person's weakness.
So, I mean, does that mean that, like, in all this time, like, for people who don't know, Akira is a master rank in Japan for Sagat and also in AE, right?
Yeah. Just for your information, it's not hard to actually become a master using Sagat in vanilla. Anyone pretty much could become a master. So that doesn't really grant any special status.
Okay. But I guess I wanted to ask you, so does that mean that you never spend any time in training mode? Like all this time when you were working on your characters in the arcade, like all the combos, all the setups, you all learn in the arcade itself at a cost of like 50 credits every time you play?
The thing is, you don't have to spend money to learn something.
Mm.
Sometimes I just, you know, if I'm really serious about the game, I go and watch top players play. And they do certain things, right? What's important is why they do it, not what they do it.
I see.
If you could reach the answer yourself as to why they do it, and you go and ask them, you don't go ask them without even looking for an answer yourself. But if you sort of had the idea and go and ask, and if you get the right answer, then that means you are thinking on the right track. And combo is something you can practice in practice mode. So sometimes I go and play against computer every now and then to practice a combo, especially before tournament and stuff. But like I said, I don't like console. So I believe all the top players in Japan, they practice on console quite a lot. Amazing amount of time. But I don't do that. A, because I'm lazy. B, because I'm not that serious. And C, I just can't be stuffed, honestly. I used to do that for Soul Strike, but not for Street Fighter 4.
Fair enough, fair enough. So, I mean, the whole point of fighting games for you is like, it's a way of thinking rather than, I mean, how you approach fighting games is not just about, you know, a video game or, you know, KOing characters, but a way of learning.
It's about discipline.
Discipline and...
Yes. It's like, some people don't really know what's going on because they don't have enough sufficient knowledge of the game. But say the players themselves, if you play at certain level or above, you can see what they're thinking and try to sort of beat that. Like I enjoy the aspect of the mind game. Yeah, so it's like I continuously think it's like a philosophical thing. It's a bit of a bull, but yeah.
I get what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's when fighting games start to transcend just being a video game and becoming like a, almost like a martial.
Actual sport.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing is that I'm not really physically fit to say, go for triathlon or something like that. I can swim, ski and do a few other sports, play a few other sports, but I'm not excellent. So obviously, human are more inclined to do something that they can do better.
They can do it better. I understand because, like, for example, I used to love playing basketball, but unfortunately, I'm a short Chinese guy. So
I don't think Chinese part has anything to do with it.
But you know, a Chinese man can't jump. But but yeah, I mean, so why try to do something that I just don't have the physical talent to do?
If you really enjoy, regardless of the result, then it may be good.
It may be.
However, as a person, I'm slightly more competitive than the others.
Yeah, yeah.
So I play, say, sports that I keep losing.
Yeah.
Then I start to really, you know, find it boring.
Boring.
So I get more frustrated than, you know.
Yeah, people are drawn to the things that they can excel at.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's sort of an interesting point, though, because you say if you keep losing, but do you think why you keep losing? As in, from the perspective of, you think that over a certain period of time, you would sit back and say, okay, I'm losing because of X, Y, Z, and then you work on those things, right?
Mm-hmm.
So from that perspective, thinking, bring the sort of fighting games is, how do you think about that growth period? And I think that's probably one of the best things about fighting games is you start off at point A and then actually you come back, say, 2 or 3 years later and say, look how much look how differently I'm playing today.
Mm-hmm.
So couldn't that be the same thing in a sport as well? that
sport in sports.
In sport, it's more of a physical thing, like you
yeah,
said.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You have to have physical attribute.
Mm. Yeah. In video games, you don't. Well, yes. You do, but not to that extent.
Not to that extent. Like, yeah, some things come to the factor, like reflexes, that kind of thing.
But you can train reflexes to a certain point. Yeah.
Can I just say one thing about reflex?
Yeah, yeah, go ahead.
I know that some players have very, very quick response. I mean, they have like lightning speed reflex.
Mm.
But most of the players whom I know they are considered as good.
It's got like...
Or top level, they have average reflex.
Mm-hmm. So like, for example, Tokido, who's considered one of the five gods of fighting games in Japan, right?
Mm-hmm.
He said that his weakness is anti-air. So kind of implying that his reflexes are kind of average as well. Is he an example that you're talking about? That he's more
I
of a
haven't
player.
Really watched him play or I don't really know him in person.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't really say definitively, but I think... He knows that he doesn't have godlike reflex, so he tries to overcome that by having a more solid defense.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't anti-air, and then you will have to block the opponent's air attack, right?
Mm.
After that, there will be more attacks to follow.
Mm-hmm.
And if he's confident enough to sort of defend it, you know,
okay.
the sequence, then he can, you know, be fine. So
on that topic, who is the most godlike reflexes player you ever seen in your travels?
Because I live in Nagoya in Japan, Momochi and Kindebu, without doubt, they are godlike in every aspect.
And even reflexes and all these other things.
Kindebu is talented in every single way.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't know why, but he seems to be able to adapt really quickly.
To any character, any situation.
Yes.
Mm. I get what you're saying. Some people just pick it up really quickly, right?
Yeah. From the American side, I would probably say Flo and Ricky Ortiz would be in that area.
Because
when you look at Flo, he's multi-talented across different types of fighting games and different types of games.
And speaking of like reflexes, do you think that in fighting games, there's an age where you're kind of past your prime, that you can't play at your maximum efficiency, really? Like an age factor?
Yeah, I used to believe that there was an age factor, and that would be around 25.
Mm. And now we're all past 25 already.
I'm way above 25. But all I can say is, if you put enough effort in, you can overcome that.
Mm.
Look at these top-level Japanese players.
Mm.
Like, some of them are around that age, but some of them are clearly above, like, even over 30s. Mm-hmm. They can play, you know. I don't know how old Sako is, but he's over 30, isn't he?
Mm, yeah, he is.
Yeah.
And Nuki as well, right?
Mm.
Yeah. Isn't Nuki over 30?
Oh, I'm not sure.
Well, Daigo is 30.
Yeah, well, then Nuki should be 30 or 20, late 20s, around that age. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, I think...
So now you reconsider, you think that the age factor might not be such a big thing anymore.
Okay, what I'm about to say may be very offensive, but anyone who uses age factor as an excuse is already losing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because I used to do that, and I know that it's an excuse.
Fair enough. Fair enough. So I guess we've kind of gone in the deep side of the questions right off the bat. So you mentioned Third Strike a little bit just now. So why don't you tell us about your history of fighting games, when you start playing fighting games?
I started playing very young. I think I started playing around 13, 14, like year 7, after primary school.
Which is in Japan?
Or? Yeah.
So you were born and raised in Japan?
Yes, I was born and raised in Japan. Mm. I spent 1 year in LA, not LA, California.
Oh, yeah. Awesome.
1 year when I was very little. I think I was 5 or 6.
Mm.
I had to go there with my dad, my family, for dad's research.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, I was purely raised and born in Japan. And I started playing Street Fighter 2, and I played a number of other fighting games.
Mm.
I even played 3D ones, like Virtua Fighter 2, Virtua Fighter 3, maybe not. But I played Virtua Fighter 2 a lot during my high school period.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I entered a few tournaments. Mm. I made it to like regional qualifier. I won like that tournament in one particular arcade, mm-hmm. and I went to the regional qualifier, and I got
bodied.
I got raped. But yeah, it was good fun. Mm. Yeah. And yeah, I just liked it so much that I kind of neglected my study.
I see.
And if you're listening to this and if you're still doing high school, you better study. Because nothing is more important than your future.
Your paycheck.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. But yeah, so I played since 12, 13. Mm. And then, yeah, I came to Australia. No, actually, hang on. I went to Malaysia on exchange back in 96 for a whole year.
Mm.
And I wanted to actually see outside Japan because I was kind of rebellious and my parents were really strict. So I kind of sort of got into this bad habit of wagging classes or not going to school. I don't know if I'm supposed to be telling this, but yeah.
It's okay, your parents will know here.
And then, yeah, I went to Malaysia and I saw the world. I mean, it's been, you know, exaggerating, but I saw world outside Japan and I realized that, you know, Japan is a small country and there's much more to it in this world. And I got to know this guy from Ballarat and he helped me enroll in Ballarat High.
Mm.
So I went straight to do 2 years of VCE.
Mm.
And then, yeah, I finished high school in Ballarat. Mm. But then I wanted to go back to Japan because Ballarat was, I wouldn't say a bit boring, but there was nothing much
to do.
Yes.
There were no arcades.
There was one, but I wasn't really playing arcade much.
Ah, okay.
So this would have been, what, around 98?
Yeah, I finished my high school back in 98. Yeah. I spent 1 year in Malaysia, the whole year 96, and I did year 11 and 12 straight after that.
Yeah.
So I completed at the end of 98, and I applied for Melbourne University Law School, but I didn't think I would get in.
Mm-hmm.
Because everyone said that it's really a hard course to, you know, get in, to get an offer. So I was sort of like already determined to go back and just, you know, enroll in Japanese university. Mm. My parents kind of wanted me back too. Mm. So I went back and then my bad habits started to sort of come out again. Mm. And I didn't really study hard or I just, you know, get going to arcade or, you know, playing other things. And then 2 years later, I'm cutting the long story short, I'm trying. Yeah, and I came back here because I had an offer from Melbourne Uni Law School and I started it. But then this is quite, you know, easygoing country.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And at university, it's like, I don't know about other sort of faculty, but for law, there's no attendance.
Yeah.
You don't have to have like 80% attendance for tutorial in order to sort of, you know, be marked as pass or, you know, not. So, yeah, it took me quite long because I did 4 year course, but it took me like 6 years or something. I mean, last couple of years, I was only like doing two or three subjects.
Yeah.
But yeah, and that was because partly of search strike, come to think. Yeah. So, yeah, first couple of years at uni, I wasn't that heavily into arcade because I was enjoying university life and I was doing other things.
It seems very interesting because you and me sort of lived very similar lives to the same perspective. When my family moved to Australia in 92, I played Street Fighter 2. And I basically played fighting games, or particularly Street Fighter 2, all the way from 92 till 98, where we moved back overseas. And from what I gather, arcades sort of started to die off in Australia in about 97, 98. And then we had that sort of the death era where 3D fighters were very popular, arcades were on the download, the consoles were basically ruling everything. Mm-hmm. You still only had very few pockets of fighting games and arcades in general. And arcades more turned into more ticket machines rather than actual cabinets themselves, which was interesting. And then when I came back to uni as well in 2002 in Australia, it seemed to be the same thing. I sort of came back and I wanted to go to an arcade, but there wasn't any arcades. There was only Blue House, White House.
Exactly. A lot of arcades shut down in late 90s, I think. They were forced to shut down because they weren't making much money. And like at one point, I kind of like went to arcade and I had nothing to play. And okay, I started playing Gundam.
Yeah.
Right? Because I had lots of Japanese friends. Okay, first couple of years, I sort of try my best to sort of make friends in law or in university who are non-Japanese. I don't mean to be racist or anything, just that I didn't think that having lots of Japanese friends around me would benefit me in any way in terms of language.
Right? I see what you mean, yeah.
Because I used to fail English back in high school in Japan. So it's like I had to, you know, polish my English. I had to improve in my English language skill, especially given that I was studying law back then. I couldn't even write a proper essay without asking my friend to actually check my grammatical errors. Like I had major, you know, mistakes that I don't even want to look at nowadays. Anyway, so yeah. And then like after a couple of years, I started to, you know, pick up Gundam and, you know, make friends with these Japanese. I wanted to just play a fighting game on a little bit on side. And there was Third Strike. I don't know if you two know Locke.
The guy, the funky guy.
He was one of them. I started to slowly, you know, make friends with the honkies, people from Hong Kong who were playing Third Strike. I practiced because back then, Kevin, aka Coach, was known as the best. And I said one day to him that you being the best doesn't mean you can't be beaten. And I wanted to prove that. And for that particular reason, I went to the OHN for the first time back in 2005, something like that. And then I came second after Paul T. Paul is very talented, by the way. Had he continued to stay and had he practiced Street Fighter 4, he may have become even closer to Toxie. And he, coincidentally enough, uses Akuma in Third Strike. But anyway, yeah, that's how I came about to Third Strike. And yeah, so I altogether played for 3 years quite seriously, because I got out of Gundam after I started taking Third Strike very serious. And I practice, and, you know, I even go to Sydney every now and then to sort of, you know, compete. Sort of wasted the opportunity to strive for academic excellence.
I see.
Because of it.
Well, that's the thing with, I mean, Australian universities, as you're saying previously, they're a lot different to other universities, especially around the world as well. Like you said, there's basically, for certain courses, there's absolutely no attendance required. All you have to do is just show up to the exam and pass. It's more of a thing where in high school and primary school, you have compulsory attendance where the teachers look after you. But in university, it's basically considered in Australia, once you've made it there, that you chose the course that you're doing and you're going to be responsible enough on your own to study on your own and be able to do it. And I think that's where a lot of people sort of misunderstand what university is really about. It's about self-learning and being able to adapt to any situation, which is sort of similar to fighting games as well, because yes, there's a community there, but in a way you have to sit down and self-understand and self-learn of what you're exactly you're trying to do and achieve. And then, you know, once when you learn that, apply that in an actual real world environment.
I completely agree. I guess I sort of shifted my energy from studying
to
fighting game and a few other things. That's probably why. I mean, before coming back here, like I was really, really sort of excited and I was happy and I was motivated to put a lot into, you know, doing well in law school. But then once I got here, it's so relaxed. Like, you know, you walk down the street, like you pass in front of the pub around 12 or 1 in the afternoon, people drinking beer, going cheese, and they go, oh my God, can I join? It's like, you know. But yeah, I mean, I don't regret, but if I had another choice to go, say, to ride on a time machine or something, I may put a little more effort into studying. Because at the end of the day, fighting game is not something that is going to put food on my table. For me, at very least. So, you know, I needed something else to support myself.
That brings us to the end of your Third Strike career, where you went to Sydney. So tell us about when you went to for your first tournament in Sydney with Rod Moe and Heat.
Okay, all right. There's a bit of a time gap between finishing the Third Strike and starting Street Fighter 4 because my Third Strike career, I mean, sort of like, not career, but playing Third Strike seriously ended back in 2007, the year I entered the SBO, representing Australia.
Yeah, so what year was that? 2007,
I think. Or six, I'm not really sure. It could have been 2006. But before that, there was a tournament called the World Warrior.
Yeah.
And we asked for all the foreigners. I mean, technically, I'm Japanese, but because I'd never played in Japan, I had no outside exposure. Yeah, so I was allowed to play
on the
as Australian. Australian. Yeah, and I entered that tournament. There were about 42 from 8 different countries. And I won the tournament. And yeah, after that, that was like held a day or two before the actual SBO. And the actual SBO, we got raped. Me, Horn, and Kevin got badly beaten by KO, one of the godlike Third Strike legends. Then after that, I sort of stopped playing.
But what a highlight, like, to finish your career at SBO, right? What was it like? Like, you go on the stage and then there's a crowd and there's like
just smoke. But it was too much of a pressure because, like, back then, right, every year, like, a bunch of foreigners go to Japan
and go
to try themselves out, and they all get their ass kicked. Even Justin won. So it's like, for us, our aim was to pass the first round because I think that year there was one team from two teams from America, one from West Coast, East West, you know, and one from Australia, one from China or somewhere, I forgot, but one of the Asian countries. And like, everyone was saying that, none of them will make it to, you know, second round.
And all of them were right. Because I think that was the year that Pyro Lee, that was the year before Gutex went over.
Oh, okay.
In 2008.
The year before Gutex, Justin
Wong, Pyro, and I think it might have been Dr. Sub-Zero.
I'm not sure.
I don't know. I just remember that, like, from the very first SBO till the year that I entered, all the foreign teams lost in the first round. Most of them OCV'd, except for Justin Wong and what's the partner of him? Who lost to Kuroda, Justin, and was it Ricky?
Ricky Ortiz?
Yeah.
Like, it was 2-on-2, and Justin and someone lost to Kuroda's Q.
The famous story.
That was 2008. That was the Gutex team.
Was it?
Yes, because Gutex lamed out the Honor Q or the...
That was like one of the very first ones.
I'm pretty sure 2008 Gutex was the team that actually made it past the first round.
And it must have been a big story.
Because
every year, all up the foreigners hope for passing the first round.
Yeah.
And their dreams, like, shatter. First round. Like,
I mean, considering last year in Super Turbo, the US team, that was the first team ever to pass the first round in Super Turbo. Third Strike was the first game ever where a foreign team actually made it past the first round. I'm pretty sure that was the Gutex team. Actually, we can ask him in 3 weeks' time.
It was really hard. I mean, there was so much pressure. And back then, there was this rivalry between Australia. I don't even know if America actually was aware of it, but like, Aussies were saying that like, we're better than Americans, and Americans were saying, what are you talking, rubbish? What? You know, kind of thing. And like, there was this heated discussion between who's better, my Urien or Ak Urien. Ak is like the best Urien in Hong Kong. And we are actually good friends. We seldom, but occasionally talk on Facebook and stuff. And we both say that, you're good. You're good too. But then, like, it's just like Toxie and Bomb. Supporters talking about, you know.
Yeah, who's better.
Exactly. So, but anyway, so, we wanted to pass the first round. But then we found out the first round's against MOV, Boss, and KO. And the team name was Last Boss.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, if you play an RPG, you have the last boss, the most strong one.
Yeah.
And we faced that one at level 1.
So, what, did MLV Steam win the SPO that year?
That team got OCB'd by Rikimaru. Oh. MLV's apparentice.
Oh, okay. Mm. So, which was the year that MLV won SPO with a broken
I think
hand?
The couple of years later, that year,
yeah.
Umezono's team won the SPO in Surge Strike. Umezono. And that's how I got to know him really well.
Umezono, okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so like, yeah, keep.
And then after the SBO,
yeah.
I stopped. I was, you know, just playing a few other games. Mm. And then Street Fighter 4 came out.
Yeah.
First, I didn't really have much intention to play, but I guess I was kind of like craving for a fighting game.
Mm.
So I played a little bit.
Mm.
And because I used Urien in Surge Strike, which is a charge character, I used Dictator, Bison.
Bison.
Mm.
Which is very interesting because most people in Melbourne know you as a Sagat player. Right.
Ask Bomb.
Bomb knows.
There was a post in Ozahado talking about my Dictator a little bit. But yeah, I think it was because Madenka?
Madenka AU.
Yeah, was trying to give advice of Dictator. He said something about, as a Bison player who's been possibly regarded as the best, if not one of the best, something like that. And then Johnny said, my Dictator was better or something. I really don't think so. But anyway, yeah. So because Johnny clearly remembers that the very first vanilla tournament that we went to sort of, you know, declare war against Sydney. We came in first three. I mean, now it's probably Sydney, you know, sort of. Rules. Only Toxic puts up a really good fight. I'm hoping that this year will be somewhat different.
I think this year we've done a lot of work. Well, I can't say we, but Melbourne has done a lot of work. And I think certain people have really grown a lot over the last year. Yeah, well, you and me still suck. Top players have... The people who consistently make the top eight in Melbourne have gotten better.
And there's a greater variety of people who make top 8, like Pharaoh.
Exactly. Somniac has really become solid this year.
So we're hoping that Melbourne will put out a better fight.
Well, we shall wait and see. But anyway, I played just one tournament back in 2008. And I left the country for a year and 2 months. I left in October 2008. And I only came back 2010 January. But when I left, I didn't intend to come back. The only reason why I came back was because I wanted to get my legal practitioner certificate. And I had to do practical legal training, which at the time of me leaving back in 2008 wasn't available for a number of reasons. I had to put myself on a waiting list, right? Because I'm an international student. I'm an overseas, you know, individual. So I had to actually, you know, put myself on a waiting list. I couldn't really study, say, online or something like that because I won't be enrolled as a full-time student and the immigration won't really, you know, grant me a visa.
It become visa issue.
So I had, you know, a visa issue. Yeah. So I left. I started playing after about 8 months, like mid-2009. Around August, September 2009. I realized that not the system, but more institute opened to provide that training course. So there were seats available. There were spots available. So I wanted to actually apply, see if I'm lucky enough to be, you know, enrolled in it. And I was, so I came back.
And by that time, you already had a lot of arcade time in Japan.
Yeah, for Street Fighter, for like vanilla. Yes, I did.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well,
you
I first... only went to one particular arcade, 5 minutes drive from my parents' place because I went back to my parents' place when I left this country. And then I played a few days with Dictator because obviously I was using Dictator here. And my instinct was to make a card with Dictator. And then after about 50 matches. I faced a huge wall, like a hurdle. This GF, no card, seems a scrub who doesn't care about anything. Just
churn the butter.
Just, you know, doing the spinning 360 SPD all the time. Or some random lariat,
yeah.
random green hand. Yeah. And back then, I didn't know how to punish.
Yeah.
And I got so salty. I got so salty, seriously. I was thinking, right, which character can give Gief a headache?
Mm.
That bald-headed Muay Thai fighter, Sagat. Okay, all right, I'm going to pick that one, all right? And then I switched my character.
Yeah.
Within a week,
yeah.
I was able to actually use it, not properly, but to a minimal standard,
yeah.
where I can do all the basic combos yeah. and do the basic anti. Of course, you just had to press heavy kick only. When, you know, it's not much of a deal. Because back then, Kara uppercut, the moving forward yeah. uppercut,
it's not discovered.
Was not discovered.
So who discovered all this technology?
I don't know, but I was one of the Sagat players in the area who was able to utilize it.
Mm.
Because like, say, back then there were a lot of Sagat players, right? A lot.
No, yeah.
In Japan, yeah. I mean, even just in Nagoya.
Yeah.
And some of them, like, say for example, if you block Ryu's heavy sweep, it's I think minus 13 or something.
Yeah,
14? Yeah. And you can Kara uppercut.
Yeah.
But then only Kara uppercut is the punish
yeah.
that Sagat has.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
can you ultra?
Yes.
Cannot. Sagat's ultra will not hit unless you block at the
right distance.
Yeah, I mean point blank. Point blank.
Oh, because you have to travel forward.
And that takes Sagat's ultra is 10 or 11, but no one would make, you know, would be kind enough to sweep point blank and let me block it.
Yeah.
Actually, the minus frames on Ryu's sweep in Super are very deceptive because you can actually hit him when his actual back is turned to you. The issue is you have to be very quick to actually input. So when the actual, you know, when the foot hits you and you have that spark, you have to actually input the motion and press the three buttons when that spark ends. Then you can actually punish it. It is extremely difficult because you only have one or two frame window to do it. And it has to be basically a Yomi sort of effect.
Yes. And the thing is, I'm pretty sure Sagat's Ultra will not be able to punish Ryu's heavy sweep because of the fact that it has to travel.
It has to travel
That's
forward.
That's the other thing.
Uppercut comes out in 5. But you need to have about 12, 13 frames.
For the Kara effect.
Yes, yeah. because you have to travel.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And if it's a tip of it, you need extra, more than a few frames to actually travel.
Yeah,
so, yeah. But anyway, I practiced a lot with Sagat and I started going to all these different arcades.
Yeah.
And I play even Momochi, I get raped, I didn't play Kindeva, I don't think. Oh, maybe I played a few games, I got raped, not to mention. And I play a few others. But then I sort of learn more and more.
Mm-mm.
And for example, like back then, if you can't play Sagat Mirror well, you're shit.
Mm-mm.
Because there were so many Sagat, right? And if you were to enter tournament, inevitably, you have a lot of responsibility as a carry of the team. And they will have almost inevitably Sagat on the opponent team. And it will come to Sagat. So if you can't deal with mirror match, what are you going to do? And I hated mirror originally because my tiger shot shooting skill was really bad back then. Because I like to attack. I don't like to just sit at the back and tiger shot. Oh, you come jump in on the car uppercut. Thank you. Or like trade uppercut ultra. Thank you. I don't like that kind of style. I like to push and push with tiger knee. So, yeah, I didn't really study, so to speak, the mechanism of tiger shot as much.
So when do you improve your tiger shot game?
I started to know two top Sagat players in Nagoya, Pierre and Dixon. And these two players, they were really good in that mirror matchup. And, yeah, I sort of started speaking to them and I asked for advice. I practiced, and they started to sort of recognize me as, you know, one of the, you know, top 5 or whatever, top 10 or top 200 or top 2000, I don't know, but one of the good players.
As a peer.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. But then unfortunately, I had to leave because I was coming back here. So, yeah.
So, just a little follow-up on the aggressive, like your aggressive nature and you wanted to attack more. Do you think that's because you played Third Strike? Or because Third Strike is very fundamentally different to Street Fighter 4. Well, one in the mechanics, but also the way Street Fighter 4 is more traditionally closer to Super Turbo in its playing style rather than Third Strike.
I think...
Where, I mean, I've heard certain people, certain people in America say that in Third Strike, life is basically irrelevant because you can parry out of situations and you can catch up on life deficiencies because of the parry system. But in Super Turbo, you can't make up life. Or you can't basically get out of a super move by parrying the entire thing. You have to take certain chip damage. So life has a bigger factor in the game.
That's an interesting point. And I agree to that. But the reason why I'm aggressive is because I just am impatient, maybe. It's like, say, if you're young... And you have a lot of time, say you're a student, right? You have a lot of time and you don't have much money. You go to arcade, you will do whatever it takes to win. Because if you lose, say you've only got $5 to spend for the day, you lose in five matches, you either go home or watch other people playing. And that's so much salt, right? So you have to make that last for as long as it can, right? So winner speaks. Loser goes home. So I would wait if I had to. But now that I've, you know, sort of grown older and money is not so much of an issue. I mean, sometimes still is. But then it's like I find it a little boring just sitting in the corner and just waiting for the opponent to make a mistake. Because like, I like to play the mind game. I don't like to wait for the opponent to make a mistake. In real life, you can't take risks in a lot of things, so you wait patiently. I do that outside the fighting game. Why do I have to do that in the fighting game? I mean, I don't deny some other people doing it. That's fine. They have their reason. But I choose not to. Right?
Okay. Very interesting.
So if I attack very aggressively and I lose, I might get salty depending on the situation, but I will eventually accept it.
Okay. Very interesting. So you were talking about your BP rank in Japan. So can you tell us about your win rates, your point ratios, that sort of thing?
Well, when I first started playing in Japan in a little arcade near my place, I had about, after the first 500 matches, I had about 94.
94 win percentage.
Yeah, because after about 5 months, six months, I lost my card. I mean, I lost my wallet. So I lost the card. I mean, I had Sagat, Gief, and Dictator. And I lost all of it. I mean, of course, Gief and Dictator, I was just mucking around, right? But Sagat, I had about 2,100 matches. My win rate was about 91 point something. So 91 to 92%. And my BP was 50,000. And that is very low for that win rate, given that I played 2,000 matches. That's because I only go to a particular arcade. So if I go up to certain BP, I will only have people, I will only have people, I mean players, who have much lower BP than me. And so by winning them,
you gain very little.
About five. So that's why people started to sort of say that I'm a scrub hunter in Japan on BVS, although I have done nothing. And like some people just pretend that, like, you know, oh, I fought that guy and he just disappeared really quickly in the speed of win when another top player came to the arcade, like, which is not true because I've never been to that arcade or something, right? But anyway, so these things started to happen and like I wanted to actually sort of explore a little more. So I started going to other sort of arcades. I mean, especially after I moved, because I started my graduate school in law in the middle of Nagoya at Nagoya University. So I moved because I was technically living outside Nagoya. But now after that, I enrolled in that course. I started, living in Nagoya, in the middle of it, and I had a lot more arcades around it, so I could go. As I continued to play with a new card, of course, my win rate was very low, but then I started to sort of, you know, gain more experience.
What's the name of your new card? Sorry.
Oh, you mean my player name?
Yeah.
BOC.
BOC. What's that mean?
Boshi.
Boshi.
Okay. Well, it's a kind of weird story because, like, I used that nickname already back in Third Strike. And people said, BOC, that sounds so gay. That means balls or cocks. And I go, no way.
Showing the true maturity of the fighting game.
Yes. Yeah. The thing is, my surname is Hattori, right? And my username in Ozhado is Akira Hat.
Yeah.
Because I'm Akira Hattori. So I use Akira Hat. Hat in Japanese is called Boshi.
Oh, okay.
So I just, you know, use Boshi. Appropriate alphabet to represent that. That's all.
Okay, okay. That
so
makes
it
sense.
Doesn't represent balls
of course.
Or cocks, neither of those, okay?
Okay.
Yeah, but that was my name. And yeah, I still remember every time I check BBS, I was so scared that they have a thread for Aichi Prefecture, where Nagoya is in, right?
Yeah.
Nagoya is the center of Aichi, right? And every time I check that particular thread, I was so worried that maybe they will talk about me as being a scrub hunter and like, this guy's a fucking weirdo or something like that, you know?
See, that's really interesting because the world perception of Japan is that Japan doesn't actually do those sorts of things. That
they
everybody
don't.
Everybody respects each other.
They don't if you'll be found out.
Mm.
But they do if it's an animus.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And that's where the message boards come in because everybody's a keyboard warrior on the internet.
Yes.
Yes. So even in Japan, there are tree monsters. And
well, in this case, thread monsters.
Thread
but
monsters.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And like sometimes they get information from nowhere. I mean, half the time it's lie, but sometimes they get hands on a particular piece of information where no one else could have possibly known other than the people who were there. And like, you can't really ask every single one of them, like, did you write that shit? Did you? Did you? You can't do that because then it's going to sort of create a bit of, you know, awkwardness. Yeah. So,
okay.
But yeah, so my name was BOC. And I still use BOC.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, I actually continued to use that old vanilla card when the AE came out. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the actual cards are transferable between
vanilla and AE.
Yes. And now AE, if you lose your card, you can actually use your mobile phone to retrieve the data and transfer it to a new one. So you have a backup system, whereas you didn't have that in vanilla.
When Takeda came down, he actually was showing me that mobile app on his iPhone.
Awesome.
Which is pretty cool.
Do you wish we had that in Melbourne? Like, I guess it's not possible because technically
our arcades are
illegal by...
Well, technically they're not illegal, but they're not actually networked to the Japanese network.
Yeah.
They're just networked amongst themselves.
Yeah.
It's quite nice that you brought up that point because I have a lot to say about that.
Okay.
One of the reasons why I don't play as much here with Sagat is because there's no BP.
So that's like a addictive fact.
No, it's sort of like, okay, BP doesn't necessarily tell you how good you are. I mean, because like you could just, you know, kill scrubs, beat scrubs and gain point.
Yeah.
But to some extent, it does show your consistency.
Yeah.
Mm. Right?
Yeah, that's true.
So if you have, I mean, reasonably high BP and your win rate is not so high, you're either gambling all the time, hoping that you will win lucky, or you challenge someone who's
better than you
all the time. Yes. So it's like, to me, it's like something that I may lose by losing the match is worse, you know, playing the game. Because if I use Sagat, I mean, I always use Yun nowadays because... Not because Yun's broken, I mean, Yun is broken, but I like the idea that Yun can just randomly attack and can beat the opponent, you know?
Okay.
Just, you know, mess them around. But Sagat, you have to sit like a fortress. Mm. You have to make the opponent move, and you take the counter of it. You sort of like, it's more like a responsive sort of a character,
reactive character.
Mm. So if there's no BP, it's quite exhausting for me to actually concentrate playing Sagat.
Ah, I see what you mean. Yeah, yeah.
Because Sagat's damage is not as high as, you know, certain characters, right? And like Daigo even said, and a lot of top players said that. I mean, I quote, in this game, in AE,
fireballs are shit.
Yes.
Yeah.
Fireballs are shit.
Yeah.
It's useless. And I have to chip a little bit by little bit with that. And, you know, anti-air properly and all these things. And it's a quite exhausting sort of match.
Yeah, yeah.
So if opponent is only trying to just win 1 out of 10, it's not worth playing for me.
Speaking of that, though, do you think that's because this game is very, well, you know, compared to other Street Fighter games or Capcom games, this game technically has very low damage? Do you think if there was high damage, like the way it was in vanilla, that it would be better? I was just say higher damage.
Yeah, yeah.
Fireball should have higher damage.
I don't really know. I think I read something about that in Ozahado, like if the sequel, I mean, if the new version, like updated one, like, you know? Changes, buffs and nerfs of the AE were to come out, should it have a higher damage or lower damage? And I think Gamogo.
Yeah,
I mean, Sydney guys always call Gamogo, so I remember him by Gamogo, but yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, well, yeah, he was saying that if it had much higher damage, people are too scared to actually make a mistake because the punish would be so much.
So then they play more defensive
author. Yes. Whereas if you have low damage, people are actually
taking more risks.
Yes, I'm willing to take more risks to actually attack and stuff. And I think he does have a point because
he does have a point,
back in vanilla, a lot of people had so much salt because they make one mistake
and they eat 70% from Sagat.
Yes, and they have to sort of stand up. No,
but that's cabinet. Because there was only one character that did that sort of damage. See, if all the characters did that kind of damage or had the potential to do that kind of damage, then the playing field would be a lot more equal. And see, and this is where I keep coming back to Super Turbo, where the majority of characters have, it's a very situational game where, for example, and I love giving this example because it was just, it recently happened at Ultimate Fighting Game Championship 7, where Damdai fought Alex Valle. And Dandan was using Old Hawk, and Vaya was using Ryu. Now, that's basically, if you take a look at the actual tier lists, that's a favor in Ryu's. That matches in new Ryu's favor. But if Hawk knocks Ryu down, he has certain option selects which Ryu has a very hard time escaping. And it's basically one of those situations where both characters have a chance to win. You just have to be careful in what you're doing and know the match and know how to play the match. And it's a lot more unforgiving. And personally, I prefer in that way because both people have to be careful what they're doing, but also know when to attack and when to do the risk reward. When to, you know, because with Street Fighter 4, I feel that majority of the people will just rush in blindly and basically just count on the Ultra system to get them out of the way. And I'm guilty of this doing wake up Ultras to people. But the other thing is people just do this and it just feels like that it's such a, it's such a bad tactic to me. It just seems that I sit here, I study the game, you know, I try to play it correctly, and then basically I just get blown up by Wake Up Ultra. And I think about it and it's like, why? Why do I even bother?
I think Capcom is a creator. They intended the game to be more beginner-friendly.
Beginner-friendly.
Oh, definitely.
So that's why they introduced the Ultra system, right? And in vanilla, it attracted a lot of new players at first. But then people started to quit because of GIF. GIF was the very first, you know, sort of beginner killer, so to speak, to make the beginners like rage quit.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the green hand, SPD, green hand, SPD, you know, some beginners couldn't really escape. And then Sagat came. Yeah. Then after that, Akuma came, the heavy kick loop. Right? And I think what you said about sort of scaling everyone's damage to a certain level, like where it's considered reasonably high, with no sort of differences between the characters. I think it's quite interesting because Akuma against Sagat, it was always a fun match to watch in vanilla. Some people disagree, but like then people say, oh, Sagat's broken with one damage. But Akuma has so many, you know, advantages in footies, zoning, wake up attacks and stuff, right? So it was pretty much Sagat's like destructive, like crazy, insane damage. More life.
Yeah.
Against Akuma's, sometimes I can't see. I might as well just close my eyes and like gamble left or right. That kind of wake up setups, you know?
Unbelievable offense.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, it was well balanced. Yeah. So I think, you know, if everyone's got a high damage, it would be quite interesting to play. And I would probably like it more. I just don't think that the general public would like to play because they will die much more quickly if there's a skill difference.
Exactly.
Right? That's what happens in Surge Strike. If you have a, you know, different skill level.
It's so apparent you die so far.
Yes, it's like me against Cyrus. Thank you, Cyrus. It's like, you know, I always give him salt, you know? Yeah. Because like he doesn't know what to do against my character. And like I know what to do against his character. He can't even get in. If he gets in, he kills in no time.
But isn't that a motivation factor for the person who's getting destroyed to get better?
But then Street Fighter 4 wouldn't be as big as it is today if it weren't so beginner friendly.
See, this is the thing that I hate about it. I hate about it that it is beginner friendly.
But then the scene wouldn't be like this if not for Street Fighter
4. That's not necessary. But the question is, do we want people like that in the scene who are just willing to give up if they're not willing to put in the time to learn to play correctly?
Well,
I mean, how many times have you been destroyed and you're still here?
Well, I mean, there are people who start off not knowing the right thing to do, but they eventually grow into people that want to learn the right way, right? So for every random guy out there, there might be maybe, I don't know, 1 out of 10 guys that will become valued members of the community.
Exactly.
So I think it's a good thing that making it more scrub friendly is, maybe it gives us salt, but
for everybody the will
big
get,
picture, it might be a
I good think there's pros and cons.
Yeah.
Like, I think you're talking more of pros and you're talking more of cons. Exactly. Like, I agree. I mean, like, Capcom is, for them, it's business, right? It's business. I mean, so it's for the arcades in Japan. So they needed to have a lot of players who are willing to put coins into the machine to play. And for that, Ultra was kind of successful, right? And then when they get beaten really badly, they quit. So in the end, the ones who actually survived all this salt and continue to play and try to improve are the ones who are only, I mean, who are hardcores.
And see, this is my point, because Street Fighter 4 is now basically coming, I wouldn't say to an end, because what it's done is similar to what World Warrior did in 92. Is it started a movement of, I'll give you a good example, Zero Kill, right? Street Fighter 4 was the first fighting game that he played. And this is the one that he grew up on and the one that he loves. And he basically said when Marvel came out and when Street Fighter X Tekken came out that he will be playing Street Fighter 4 till the end of days for him. And I'm similar to like that with Super Turbo, right? But imagine how many people have actually picked up Street Fighter 4, played it for X amount of months, and actually don't bother to continue with it. Now, from Capcom's side, yes, I understand it's a business. They need to sell units to make money, obviously. But in the long run, I think it's people like Zero Kill are the ones who will continue to buy all Capcom-based products because they fell in love from that first game. That, you know, and it's not just the game. It's more of the community aspect of the game that really will make him a bigger fan of Capcom, which will continue to purchase their other products down the line. And I think that's the sort of people that you want to attract as your target audience. Not somebody who will go out, oh, I remember Street Fighter, blah, 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 buys it and then plays it for a month and then never plays it again. That's not the sort of member that you want buying your titles in the long run.
So would you rather...
It's a quick cash in.
Would you rather have a third strike where the skill entry was so high that casual gamers couldn't get into it at all? Like...
That's not necessarily true. Third Strike's entry level now seems very high. But when Third Strike first came out, its entry level wasn't that high.
Okay.
Same as when World Warrior came out, when Champion Edition came out, because nobody played that game. because we had Rainbow Edition, and then we had Super Street Fighter 2, which they had Hyper Fighting, which was probably one of the best balanced of the SF2 series. And then we had Super, which was extremely slow, and then we had the revolutionary Super Turbo, who now people have played for almost 20 years. And even on GGPO today, you can still get, like, when the Japanese Masters come online, you get people up to 130, 140 people going online and just viewing their matches.
But it's still nothing compared to what Street Fighter 4 has done for the worldwide community.
What Street Fighter 4 has done for the worldwide community is just reboot the community.
It's made it even bigger than it was before.
That's not necessarily true, because the time that we're living is completely different to the way when Super Turbo came out.
Why do you think, Akira?
I think I completely understand where Eagle is coming from, because I'm probably one of those hardcore players. But given the fact that arcades are dying in Japan, and I know that the companies, I mean the game makers, don't really want to spend much money. It's no longer an investment. It has become gamble for them to actually make a fighting game. So I can understand why they went for a short-term cash. I mean, borrowing your terminology. Yeah. So, because I don't think they intend to actually continue to make Street Fighter 4 sequel or like tribute or whatever, like one after another, because they don't have enough resource, I believe.
And SNK is a very good example of that.
Yeah, exactly. As said, I mean, it makes me really sad to say this, but like even Tokita agrees, the arcade scene's dying, the fighting game community is near its extinction.
As an arcade form, but we have to move to the new generation.
And I think to do that, this kind of community sort of based sort of
on console, on local meetups, and etc.
Yeah, all these things is a good model that we as Japanese should actually sort of look up to and try to sort of not copy but learn from it. Yeah, and I think that's what some of the players in Japan are trying to do together with like some legendary players like Daigo and stuff. I mean, I don't know much in detail, but I think that's what they're trying to do. So it's in a transition period.
Yeah, see, I think the West has already gone through that transition period, because our arcades basically died in the beginning of the 2000 era. You only have, what, 5-6 arcades? And even like Henry Sen's new arcade is basically console-based. He only has 8 machines and the majority are consoles.
Where is it?
Henry Sen's in New York. He has an arcade.
Because Chinatown Fair closed down, right? So they open up a new arcade called The Next Level, which is basically like a, it's like a like arcade land shop, but with consoles.
And has arcade machines in it.
So
I think arcade machines, like, very expensive.
Oh, definitely.
Out of proportion, like nowadays. So
when you compare an arcade machine to a console will cost you, say a brand new console, or on release day will cost you about $1,000. An arcade machine will cost you about $5,000 for the board, and then another $2,000 or $3,000 for the actual cabinet itself, which is far more than a console, which can then basically get more games into it if you wish. Now, I know that Japan's working on the new system of where you can get multiple games on multiple of the same arcade, and that, you know, SNK again had that with the multi-video system where you can put in different cartridges and stuff. But it's the console's just outweigh the arcades in these days.
Because I know that Street Fighter 4 AE in Japan, I think when it first came out, it costed about,
I think it was about 23,000?
No, not that much in Japan. It was about 1.4 million yen. So assuming that the current exchange rate is about 85, about 15, 16 grand for two setups, including everything. And that's still quite expensive, you know.
Oh, definitely.
Especially, no, I mean, for if, imagine if you're an arcade owner, you buy that. It might take a year to actually get the money back. And Capcom may release the console version down as a download content or some crap in less than half a year. I mean, how are you going to make money out of that?
Yeah, and that was the other model that I think Capcom made a mistake on. where they released arcade edition with 16 characters?
You mean vanilla?
Vanilla, yeah.
Yeah, with 16 characters.
Yeah. And then the console edition basically had another 16.
Another 16?
I don't know, but a lot
more. A lot more.
And that pissed arcade owners off.
Exactly.
Really badly. I tell you, I want to voice this out because a lot of arcades in Japan decided not to buy AE because of that.
Mm.
Because it was more than 14 grand.
Yes,
the original vanilla. Mm. Because of the cabinet, Vuelix, it's really expensive.
Yeah.
Right? And someday, actually, because it's like kind of like a fighting game that hasn't been released for the last 10 years and it's going to be kind of like a refresh start or something, and they bought it. And within like how long was it before the console release?
Half a year? It was about a year.
About a year. Yeah. But certainly not, I mean, no more than a year and a half, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So they, even before they get the money back, the game. Capcom released their console version and the arcade scene started to die.
They basically completely invalidated the entire arcade scene. And this is, in a way, fault of the West, because the West's arcade machine or scenes died. And Japan was the only real, you know, place in the world where arcades still have a huge presence at that time. And that's the thing, because Japan, and you can correct me on this, but from what I've, you know, read and understand, is Japanese arcades are more of a social gathering place where young people go to meet and hang out and have fun, because they don't, because there isn't as many other social areas where they can go out and do things.
The houses, the apartments are quite small.
Definitely compared to Australia.
Yeah. Exactly.
They have these sort of game centers.
Like house.
Yeah, so they have these game centers where they can meet up and actually, you know, then go off and do other places. But
in, say, for example, like, say, if you have an entertainment complex, you have an arcade, you have ten-pin bowling, you have karaoke. I don't know what else you have, but like all these things are joined together.
Exactly.
So arcade is part of it to have fun for, like, you know, youth and even slightly older people, right? And I think people in West don't often realize is the fact that there are so many arcades, they compete with the price. So obviously, if one place has Street Fighter for $1 a credit and the other one has for $2 a credit, this second one is forced to bring the price down. And there's like lowering price competition going everywhere. And especially if you're really keen to play, you go to the one that is cheaper, right? And that's like actually arcades struggling each other because they're not making much money at the end, right? So it's really hard for arcade to actually make profit. And Capcom just doesn't seem to care.
Exactly.
Because all the money comes from console anyway. It doesn't make sense for them to care about arcade.
Yes, exactly. And Capcom kind of knew that, and that's why originally they weren't going to release arcade edition,
which I thought was very interesting, because the Capcom arcade, you know, that division of Capcom actually shut down in 2005 or something like that. They basically said that they will be no longer making any more arcade machines or arcade games, since they basically, I mean, originally they had, you know, Capcom's PlayStation 1, PlayStation 2, PlayStation 3. And then they basically moved to Sega's Naomi boards because they said, well, this division is costing us too much money. We're not getting any return. You know, we're not seeing the profit margins we want. We're going to outsource it to Sega. And that's when you had the Dreamcast, basically Naomi 1, Naomi 2, Naomi. Those arcade systems. And then basically since after CVS2 was released on arcade, and that was one of the last to show the arcade games which Capcom actually produced. Now, again, I'm pretty sure I'm wrong here, but that's from my memory and recollection of it. And that they basically shut down the entire division down. Yeah. And then I found it in 2008. Fascinating. They went out and said, are we going to release Street Fighter 4 on arcade?
They must have had someone like you who is hardcore believing in fighting game, someone who had certain authority or power to make decisions. But that's like one hell of a rare case. I don't know how it came to happen. I don't. But I believe what you said basically, you know, tells the story that, making fighting game for arcade release is no longer viable. Worth it. Yeah, exactly. Viable.
That's a sad reality.
It's the world we live in.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we do still have another form, like we're in transition, like I said, and like you guys have shown the example, like we have a great community, which brings us to the next topic.
Exactly.
I mean, how do we evolve the community into something better? Should we just have a community as a gathering place, or should we have a community where people sort of like may even from time to time have rivalries and try to sort of improve and get better, raise the overall standard? That is another question.
So then let's talk about the Australian Street Fighter community. Especially now, since I would actually say since Vanilla came out, the Australian Street Fighter community or fighting game community sort of started to revive itself slowly. Now, I know sort of what I was from speaking from Toxie and some of the other players before Super Street Fighter 4 and Street Fighter 4 Vanilla came out. It was basically only about really 10, 15 people playing fighting games in a higher competitive manner. And then we had this huge sort of influx of older people who used to play Street Fighter 2 that sort of jumped on the Street Fighter 4 bandwagon. And in a way, I would say it's also because there was an arcade release. People felt very nostalgic and went back to the arcade. And then when console came out as an, you know, Super Street Fighter 4 as an exclusive, that's when we started getting this evolution happening in the Melbourne community. And we started up, you know, Couch Warriors was always sort of the beginning. But then the Couch Warriors was having an issue, at least in the Melbourne community, with the arcade people not wanting to go to Couch Warriors because Couch Warriors was seen more as casual or arcade was seen more as hardcore. But then the transition began when console only came out. And then basically we had those arcade players playing in an older version and going, well, this isn't the new version. We want to play the new version. Let's step over to Couch Warriors, and Couch Warriors started evolving. That's a sort of brief history of the way things happened in Melbourne. But now you're actually, Akira, it seems to me like you're actually hinting at something higher than that, not just people showing up every week to play, but to actually play for a higher purpose in
like,
a way.
Like regimental training sessions.
Something like that.
Before I start, I mean, big props to Loki for, you know, having such a successful, you know, community group known as Couch Warrior. Not that I've attended before, unfortunately, for a number of, you know, coincidental reasons.
You were at BAM. That's part of Couch Warriors.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, I can't sort of, you know, thank him enough for having such a great community. And, yeah. So.
But the other thing is, see, from Couch Warriors, we also spun off to Chris's Clubhouse. Then we spun off to where we are today at Deacon.
And the arcade tournaments came back.
And then the arcade tournaments came back. So we're sort of moving to some sort of
integrated kind of like no more arcade, console, clear distinction. But it's more of a hybrid, But, well, I think it's a good thing, right? And, I mean, when I look at the community, right? I mean, there are two types of, like, I think everyone knows. There are two types of players. One, simply being happy to just choose a character and do whatever with the character. Win or lose, right? That possibly be majority. And minority, we've been referring to as hardcore. Who want to actually sort of practice and get better, and when they get raped, they get so salty that, you know, they react quite crazy.
Well, sometimes. Very emotionally.
Yeah, very emotionally. I've seen some, but yeah. And you should not, you know, mention the name.
No, we won't mention any names, but yes.
Well, and to me, the former is fine. The latter, I mean, certain people, they've sort of made propositions of getting the Australian community, if not the Melbourne community, but like Australian as a whole, Street Fighter 4 community should be recognized worldwide. And we, you know, we deserve to have certain attention, etc. I really think it's a good idea, except you need to really plan it. I mean, no offense to them, I just don't think that we are kind of quite ready for it, because like to be really good at fighting game, you have to sacrifice a lot. You can't just, you know, say be a successful, whatever, like a business owner or something and play Street Fighter like when you have spare time and be godlike. Toxie doesn't do that. Like Toxie had to put a lot of effort in. to be where he is right now. And so is everyone else in the world who's well known. And some people with a lot of spite who can't beat those top players say that all these top level players are like dropout in real world. I mean, I take that as a lame excuse of losing. But that partly, you know, sheds lights to the fact that these players have risked, I mean, have sort of, you know, risked a lot to be where they are. And if the community wants to be given certain attention worldwide, certain people have to stand up. But that doesn't mean that the rest can actually just sit and, you know, watch TV.
And do nothing or not contribute.
Yes. And community as a whole has to work together. Then there becomes a problem when the majority is just a casual player who want to actually just enjoy, because these players will not contribute, and that's fair enough because they just want to have fun. So it comes to how desperate these hardcore players are to get this attention. But at the moment, okay, this is purely my personal opinion. I don't think these hardcore players are putting enough effort in to actually raise the standard, except for Toxie.
But how are some of the ways that you think these players can help raise the level of the community? I mean, what can they do? What do you think they can do?
Well, first of all, you have to play the game until you hate it. I'm not joking. I'm serious. I've always said this to a Surge Strike players. To be good in Surge Strike is like studying a subject at university and getting a really good grade. You have to do a lot of things. You have to spend a lot of time. You have to sacrifice. Sometimes, you know, you can't spend time with your girlfriend or with your friends because you have to check frame data. So you have to watch videos.
Which normal beats, which normal in this situation, this distance.
And it's not an easy path. So if you're not serious about it, you shouldn't say that you want to improve. It's easy to say. And then when I try to teach them, give them advice, they say, I can't do it. Well, then why did you say it in the first place, that you want to improve? It's a very, very serious, strict, like, stoic thing. It's really hard. Yes. That's why I say it's part of discipline for me to play fighting game. Because you have to have a very strong, like, iron will to succeed.
But the problem is that everyone only has, you know, a certain limit that they were willing to go to sacrifice. And it's not really, I guess, I don't know, can anyone out there say what should be the limit that they should sacrifice? I mean, it's up to the person themselves.
Right? So this is where I find something very interesting, what Tokido told me last year. And told us during our interview as well, that when he was going through high school, how many hours did he spend practicing a day?
Like 10 hours a day and 10 hours studying.
Exactly.
And then he slept like 3 hours a day or something.
Yeah. So that's...
But who can do that? And well, Tokido is like a genius or something, but...
Well, see, I don't think Tokido is a genius.
Extremely hardworking guy.
He's extremely smart, I'll give you that.
But he's put a lot of work in...
Exactly. A lot of work.
Yes.
And there is a common pattern that from the interviews that I've seen over the years with Daigo, Mago, Tokido, all the world famous big names, when they're asked how much did you play in your youth, they always give the numbers in high double digits every day. You know, to them it basically became like their way of living. And that's, I think, something that Akira is sort of trying to say here, that the amount of time that you practice, you have to take this as a professional sport. When I played basketball professionally, I had five training regimens a day. Basically, I get up at 6 a.m., I run for 3Ks. I come home, I basically then have to study for school. I go to school, I come home, then I got my gym workout for 2 hours. Then I have practice for 3 hours. Then I basically have second gym where I basically do stretches and so forth. Then I go to bed. And I did that basically 6 days a week. And then on the seventh day, we would have a day of rest and we would play games. Day in, day out, you basically become a machine.
But okay, to be devil's advocate here, to say, to go back to something Akira said, he said that fighting games right now isn't something that can put food on the plate for you, right?
And that's the thing.
And I think that is the same. That is the case for most people in the world, right? Or even just in
without Hong Kong. A doubt. And so that's my point.
It's a lot to ask for someone to do that for, you know, a career that
can't feed yourself. That's the thing. It becomes a career, but in a way, it's a perfect balance. I mean, again, going back to what Sarko said last year, was when he comes home from work, he spends about 7 to 8 hours playing in training mode and practicing and playing online. So that's what I mean. It's in a certain way that this is treated as a, if you want to become the best of the best, you have to have that sort of mentality. And again, there is no money in it, but I'm not sure what their motivation is.
The motivation is that
to be the best, I guess.
Yes, and when they put so much effort in, the victory becomes even sweeter. When they achieve something, you know? And maybe part of it is also because they simply enjoy it.
Exactly. They don't see it as a training regimen. It's just to them, and I guess I can say this for my job, is to me, my job isn't my job. It's a place where I go to 8 hours a day and I actually have fun because I love doing what I do. I don't see it as a grueling work thing where I have to sit there and do, you know, my job. It's a place where I go to have fun. And then when I come home, I'm tired, but I feel self-satisfied that what I did. And I guess that's the same way you have to look at fighting games for the Kidos of the world, for the Margos of the world, for the Daigos of the world.
And adding a little bit more to what Igor said, even though you say you love the work, sometimes you have shit days, right? Of course, right? Yeah, or shit time, like shit moment. The same goes for, like, you know, fighting games. You don't love it and enjoy it every single moment. Even Margo sometimes loses to some, you know, not so popular players. And he might, you know, feel like throwing a Coke can at them. I mean, he doesn't do it. He's a really, you know, polite gentleman. But what I'm saying is, you can't just have fun 100% of the time.
There's bound to be rocky moments and salt mines.
And you have to have a strong will to overcome that and continue to progress.
And see, that was one of the reasons. My point was about the type of people that you want to get into this kind of community. Because 90% of the people who get into this go in as a fun, you know, they're the ones that Capcom wants to sell to. You know, let's just call them the casual gamer, and I hate using this term, but the casual gamer.
But think of the big picture.
Oh, I understand.
Where does the money come from to make Street Fighter 4 if not for the 90% of these casual gamers? If not for these millions or thousands of casual players, the hardcore community wouldn't have this game to even play.
That's why it starts to take a whole different dimension when someone says that, let's improve the community standard in gameplay, because most of the players are not there in the community for that. They're happy to watch it, but if they've been asked to contribute in some way, they're really, really reluctant. I mean, if not hesitant. I mean, because they only want to enjoy. They don't want to actually, you know, go through rocky road. Yeah.
Like Loki.
Well, I would actually say more me. Because if you notice that this year I have actually scaled back on my involvement in the community. Because, well, there were certain other issues which sort of prevented me from that. But also because I realized that I'm getting to a point in my life where as much as I love the community and I love it and love being involved, but certain other issues in my life do take a little bit more priority at the moment. I've realized when I first started playing fighting games, just when I started playing basketball, that I will never be a Michael Jordan in fighting games, just like I will never be a Michael Jordan in basketball. I still love playing it, and I love the theory of it and all the meta games and everything, and I understand that concept, but I realize that I will never be one of those guys.
Yeah, well, just like you, Igor, I mean, my good friend Andy, the big boss.
The Zangief player.
Yes. He stepped back a bit because he had other priorities in life. And I completely, you know, understand that. And last time I spoke to him, he said that now that he can enjoy the game much more because he just plays to have fun. And he even added that if he beats someone who's been playing 24/7, not 24/7 literally, but who's been playing a lot more compared to Andy, who can only play maybe once a week or even once a month, then if he could win, he gets so much more satisfaction out of it. So there's this sort of two different sides in the fighting game that cannot sort of mix. One is to take it lightly and have fun and give priority to other things. The second one is to actually give the first priority to fighting games, sacrifice others, and be the best. That's why they are the best. They put a lot more in. And I just don't think in this community, say for example, like the Tech Brothers, they do a lot backstage, you know? Amazing amount, just like Loki, right? And without them, there was no Shadaloo Showdown last year, not this one. So to ask, say for example, Saul to improve, that's a bit too much to ask, you know? Because they're already doing the backstage job, just like you, Eagle, or you, man. So it should be like a job of, say, me or Toxie or someone else if we are willing to sort of, you know, bring up the community level. But we can't do it alone or like just two or three. We need more people. And I, you know, I don't want to sort of mention names, but certain players who are regarded as like top players in Melbourne, they just, to me, they probably have little more time that they can spend it on, but they choose to spend that on other things or other priorities. So I just think that it, unfortunately, we don't have the environment to sort of grow stronger in terms of the standard. So if we keep saying it, it's going to just put pressure on these top players and it's just going to sort of do bad.
So what do you think of Toxie being in Los Angeles?
It's a good thing.
This month.
It's a good thing. I mean, if he's happy, I'm happy for him, you know? I mean, and obviously,
he's going to improve a lot.
And he won't do it easily. I mean, he has to put effort in, right? Of course. I didn't even know what hitbox was until someone explained to me that it is a pad. It's like a controller for people without stick. And I go, how do you play without stick? Buttons. What? You already have six buttons. And then they go, oh, you have like extra buttons instead of a stick. And like, you know, okay, I see. And like, you know, to me, even if someone's willing to pay me and send me to, you know, the, where is it?
Los Angeles.
Yeah, LA, to the LA to actually practice that and do well in the tournament. I say, no, I can't.
So you two use the stick.
No, not that. That's an enormous pressure and you have no responsibility, if not obligation, to perform well. And I don't like to be put under that much pressure. That's why I sort of step back and I don't enter as much, as many tournaments as I used to because I can't perform. And like I said, I'm competitive. If I enter the tournament, I only aim for the number one. I don't aim for anything else. I don't set off for number two. And luckily, in all the vanilla tournaments I entered, I came first. But that's because I had enough time to prepare for it. And I was motivated enough. Not so for AE.
So, I mean, to switch gears a little bit, you were saying that you picked Sagat in vanilla, but then in Super, you had a lot of problems because you felt that, you know, you had to play a more turtley style.
You're talking about console Super?
Console Super, yeah.
I hardly ever played.
Yeah, but what's the reason? You didn't like Sagat in that Super version, right? Because you couldn't play it aggressively as you wanted, with the tiger knee pressure, things like that.
Yeah, well, I couldn't. And another thing was that it's console, right?
Oh, so that's the major thing for you.
Yeah, well, that's major thing. Then the second major thing was that I wasn't willing to pick up another character and put a lot of effort in where the fighting field is only limited to console. Because I'm purely arcade bred. I like to sort of play, not face-to-face, literally, but you know what I'm talking about, right? Like side-by-side cabinet, and you play, and after the match, sort of you talk, and you exchange info and stuff, And you socialize. Like you said, it's a socializing sort of place for me. And if that's not going to happen, and if it's going to be only taking place mainly online where there's a freaking 10 million like frame lag or some shit, or once a week gathering, because once a week gathering is not enough for me to gain experience, right? So, and obviously if I want to play, I want to play slightly more hardcore.
That's another actually interesting thing that you mentioned right there. Is because lately, what's actually been happening, and I've noticed this happening a lot more, is on Xbox Live, we're having smaller and smaller groups of people come on every night and actually play together and discuss things. And there's currently a project which me and Heavy Weapons are involved in. We're trying to sort of start up a sense of, like, having one day a week to basically come on in a smaller group of people, and this is just going to be a pilot thing where we sit down and we take some of the matches that we had over the week. We sit down, we review them in the review channel. And we actually sit down and discuss the matches, the outcomes, why you did things this way, what happened here, what could you have done better, you know, and so forth.
That's a good thing. That's a good idea.
Yeah. And originally it started off as a Heavy wanted to just have some YouTube videos recorded for Soul and stuff and have them uploaded. And then I sort of came along and said, all right, so it's time for Replay Mondays, because I was sort of bored and I wasn't playing Super Street Fighter 4, but I enjoyed watching it. So I said, well, let's have a look. And then, you know, we had a couple of more people come along, and yeah, it sort of turned into this sort of place where on Monday night, we would all, like four or five of us, would get into a replay channel and we watch matches that people have had throughout the week, either ranked or, you know, against in casual sessions and so forth. And I think that's actually probably the new avenue, because the majority of us are getting older who are actually playing these games to put it, air quotes, seriously to a certain perspective. And I think, you know, when I come home from work, I know that Monday night, basically from say 8 o'clock till about 10 o'clock, I'm going to be in this Xbox Live room with four or five people talking about Street Fighter and how I did during the week. And then basically what the other thing that what I've noticed is that throughout the week, as I'm playing, those same sorts of people join those lobbies and we actually play together and we try to explore certain aspects of the game, you know, and so forth, which I think is actually, I think it's slowly getting there on its own, similar to the way the arcades were in the 90s, but now in an online environment. The only problem with that is that Australia's internet sucks and we can't get that one-to-one arcade feel, but I would say that it's about 80% there, because the people you usually play with are the people who in your local community who you usually have a semi-decent connection with. So it's sort of slowly getting to that point. Now, maybe I just overplayed my cards a little here, but this is something that we're sort of thinking about doing.
It's good. It's good. And that just sort of reminded me what Momochi wrote in his blog that I happened to actually read. If you cannot explain every single move as to why you did it and what you were sort of
what you were thinking,
you're too soft. That's what he said.
You're too soft.
Yeah, exactly. And this is something that I learned from playing card games a lot. There's this old in Croatia. There's a card game called Belot, which is actually but you play it. And what my dad told me is you get 7 cards, 4 different suits, and every card you have to have an idea as to why you're playing this card and what its purpose is in this hand that you're playing. And I find that it's fighting games are very much in that perspective.
Exactly.
It's, you know, why am I doing this and what is its purpose that I'm doing it for? Yeah.
And what are you trying to achieve?
Exactly. Yeah, by doing this.
Yes. And it just, in card game, each turn may take slightly longer time and slightly bigger sort of impact
exactly
in the whole picture, whereas fighting game lots and lots happen but still the principle remains the same. You have to be able to explain
intentions,
because otherwise you'll be just doing things
autopiloting.
Yes.
So one other thing that we sort of touched on was, you know, speaking about the community, what, how do you feel about, and this isn't just for the Australian community but in general, how do you feel about player sponsorship? Because today we found out that Margo has been sponsored by Mad Catz. So he's basically joined Daigo on the team.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's a good news for him.
Mm. But how do you feel overall about brand name sponsored players? Do you think they have an unfair advantage for the up and coming players trying to achieve, you know, that to get to the that stage of Taquito and Margot's sort of, I'm just using them as, you know, getting that 10-hour grind that we were speaking about.
I don't think so, because to get the sponsorship you have to be at that level already. So it's not like getting there gets you advantage. You have to be there to get the sponsorship, right?
It's not like, you know, they've started playing fighting games a couple of years ago. They've been playing and decades. Finally the hard working blood, sweat and guts, the effort have crystallized into something called sponsorship.
Yeah.
So obviously for this, like say if you're about 10, 12 years old now and then you're trying to sort of, you know, follow the path of the, you know, these godlike players, it will take a long time. But now that the field is starting to sort of, you know, become more solid, it's to their advantage, I think, rather than disadvantage. Mm-hmm. And I personally think that sponsored players have a lot of responsibilities, right? Mm-hmm. People say that in Japan, Daigo switched from Ryu to Yun because he is professional. He has to win. He has to win. Yeah, provide a result.
Does he feel that he has to win?
Well, it's probably like one of those sense like of unspoken code.
That he needs to provide results.
Yes, that's why he switched to Yun, right? So, and I completely understand. People say that, like, you know, oh, Daigo, like, slightly become ordinary, less exceptional by switching from Ryu to Yun, because Yun's already broken, right? I mean, someone who's slightly less skilled than Daigo using Yun could still almost be the same as Daigo. So Daigo's sort of like magic sort of skill doesn't show much. Yeah. Then I say, so what? He's professional. Professional has to win most of the time. So if you're losing most of the times, you can't smile, because at the end of the day, win or lose directly relates to how much food he gets on his table. So, I mean, what right have you got to say that, you know, he's less exceptional or anything? So I understand. And I still think, you know, his Yun is very, very strong. I don't want to play his Yun. I'll probably have nightmares.
But yeah, I mean, before we started on this tangent, I was going to ask you what you thought of AE, because now you're playing Yun in AE.
So as a game?
Yeah, as a game, as in the balance, what do the Japanese think of AE? Why are you playing Yun?
Just to clarify, my main is Sagat, and it will never change.
Okay.
He's sexy, that's why. All right? Even in middle of winter, he's only wearing shorts or spats or whatever, right?
Yeah.
That's so, you know.
So sexy. But
yes. Hardcore. I use Yun. Because I told you that there's no card, so I don't feel like continually using Sagat for so many random casual matches. And B, because I just, you know, play a little more laid back. So I want to have fun. Right? And Yun, even when I lose, I know that I lost because I attacked too much and I ate too much random uppercut or like well-calculated uppercut. I don't know which one it is, but I lost because I ate uppercut, you know, Metsu or uppercut Ultra. But at the end of the day, it's still, you know, fun.
Okay.
And as to your question, what I think of an AE, I already knew that it was going to be as bad as this. Because last year when Taquito came, I asked him just one simple question, because he said that he'd already played AE. Before the release, and he said, just, you know, really naturally, it's nothing like Super. The balance is broken.
He basically said the same thing to me as well.
And Taquito, one thing that I respect a lot about him is that he has eyes to sort of predict
tiers, the balance.
He's actually very analytical as well.
Exactly. Because his favorite quote in fighting game is, set play never betrays you. It's never going to be random. Set play is set play, and it's all frame data, numbers, and like 50-50 if that's the case. It's like probability. And in long run, it will never let you down. That's his, you know,
philosophy.
Yes. And I really agree. And he put a lot of effort into sort of calculate and try to set up these, you know?
Like a scientist.
Yes.
Scientific approach. Yeah. And he is a scientist.
Yeah. And that's the way I like to approach it as well. But yeah, please continue.
Yeah. So I already knew that it was going to be as bad. And people just complain about Yun mainly. Right? I don't know why they only complain about you, because in Japan I experienced so much crap from Fei Long.
Yeah, and Yang.
Yes. They're equally bad. Not the players. Like, I think it originally came from Daigo, Mago, Tokido, some like those well known player. Mm. But they said that this is a game about who can beat Fei Long.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other characters who don't have that bad matchup against those three characters.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah.
So therefore, like for example, Viper is very broken too. Except the fact that Viper can't do well against Yun or Yan, I think. I don't know about Fei Long, but I think it's a tough matchup. Mm. That's why Viper is not like ranked top tier. Right? So it's pretty much Yun Yan Fei Long game.
It's like third strike again, right? Chun and Yun.
Chun, Yun, Kang.
So do you like that? Do you think it's good for the game to have this sort of, you know, triple-headed dragons oriented?
It's similar to rock, scissors, paper, or Junkin. Where each one kind of counterbalances the other to a certain point. Except for, in this case, you just have the three types who are all the same. Okay. But if you take a look at the twin versus twin match, it's whoever really attacks first usually outcomes the winner. And it's really kind of interesting, because we've sort of shifted from super, which was fairly turtly, to now more of a aggressive style with the three basically rushdown of, you know, the twins and Fei Long.
And I think part of the reason why people pay much more attention and they hate much more of Yun than, say, Yan or Fei Long. Probably Yan, you haven't seen it firsthand. And more of Fei Long. Fei Long doesn't have flashy, like, random, like,
no, like EX crazy,
but he is just solid.
He is really crazy solid. And if you play, say, first of 10, first of 10 against Fei Long, like a really solid player, you're probably not gonna wanna play the game for like a month after you play that 10 matches.
Yeah.
Because I use Sagat, right?
Yeah.
I play like some like reasonably good Fei Long players, or like really good ones, right? I spew. I can't do shit. It's beyond mind game.
You're infinitely in block stun, for example.
Yes.
Or you get in situations where you cannot do literally anything, and it's basically a 30-70 guess where 30% of the chance that you'll get out with maybe taking, you know, 100 or 200 damage.
And to beat the match, I have to do random shit. But random shit will not get you victory all the time. And I don't like to rely on that random shit all the time. Right? For example, I tiger shot, ground tiger shot in like certain distance. After Fei Long block, okay, block on block. After that, if he does Rekka,
he can hit you, right?
No, I have to block.
Oh, you have to block.
All right? I can't do anything. And you may think, it's just block. What? You get pushed to corner.
Yeah.
You can't jump against Fei Long. If you actually do wrong tiger knee, and if you get it gets blocked, you get punished really bad. Fei Long's command grab deals 400 damage to Sagat. Because Fei Long has character specific, like after command grab, standing medium punch, cheeky wing, heavy punch,
Rekka dragon kick.
That's like 400. And Sagat is one of the characters. It hits.
And Cammy as well, right?
I'm not really sure. Kami, I try not Makoto. To try not to know much as much of Fei Long as possible, because I hate that bastard. But yeah, so it's like, you know, it's just, oh my god, why? Like, okay, I saw this thread in Ozaharo, someone saying Fei Long's not a top tier or not such a great character. I'm sorry to that guy, but it was a really, really entertaining thread to read. I would not comment on that, but I've seen Fei Long in Japan and how bad that can be.
Yeah, watching Margot to play and Revelations was an eye-opening experience of where Margot's Fei Long was in Super and the way he just basically mauled through the competition today in the States. And, you know, the States, okay, to be fair, they haven't had the game for as long, but the things that they were doing, it was just an eye-opening experience.
But so what do you think of the long term, how AE will pan out? Do you think the balance of the game will affect the lifespan of it?
I don't know. I just Okay.
You think the top 8 at EVO will be Yun 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 Yun, Fei Long Fei Long Fei Long Yang?
Okay, put it this way. If it's just one match,
anything can happen.
A lot of characters have chance. Okay? Because
the way the game system is set up.
Yes. Well, like one like big guess and you can launch Ultra or something like, I don't know. But it's still anyone's game. Of course, there may be a gross disadvantage like Gief, Sagat and stuff. But still, you can win. That's why a lot of the, say, for example, tournament like NSB or this is SBL, it's not single.
It's team.
Yes. To sort of try to make it slightly more
character variety.
But still, it's not going to help as much. Okay?
Yeah. There's still Yuns on like every team, right?
And I mean, for vanilla, I know the fact that, okay, this is just Japan. I don't know about elsewhere. But a lot of hardcore Japanese players, especially top levels, like non-Sagat players, okay? They love to fight Sagat.
Because they play that match all the time, right?
No, because when they beat it...
Oh, they feel good.
Really good.
Oh,
they some even said, I played that game to beat Sagat. And Akuma.
Okay.
So we have that kind of very strong mentality. I mean, we always complain, but we at the same time we put effort in try to sort of analyze the character matchup, etc. But like, I don't know about Yun, because Yun is not as, like, I used to say that Yun's more broken than Vanilla Sagat, and I want to apologize because Yun's not as broken as Vanilla Sagat. Fei Long, probably not still. Vanilla Sagat was very broken. But that's why people really sort of like to sort of beat Sagat. Now Yun, Yan, and Fei Long, and the style that Yun and Yan uses, especially for example, like Yan just super, that duplicate, say Ambu, and like you have unblockable and really hard mix up to block, and like it's just the style that people don't like, you know. Sagat is just broken damage. But if you're really good with footsie and all these things,
you can beat him.
Yun and Yan, whereas it's just different style. It's like they're much,
they have so much advantage on certain moves that some characters, it's basically a suicide mission.
Yes.
Or what I like to think of it is like Sagat plays the game in a linear way. You know, horizontal planes, vertical planes, tiger shots, uppercuts. Yun and Yang play the game in like angled ways. They can change the vectors of the game. They can attack you from different
command grabs.
Command grabs are part of it as well.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah,
being +1 on lunge punch.
EX
lunge punch basically gives him 4 options: normal grab, crouching short, or crouching crouching light punch, crouching light kick, or command grab. So you have basically 4 guesses every time of what he's going to do.
Well, exactly. Say you block EX lunge punch, right? You're -1. Even if you have 3 frame move, if Yun does crouch light punch fastest, you'll be eating it, right? And if you block, right? If you block, you EX grab. EX grab's 5 frame startup. From the very first frame, it's throw invisibility.
You try to crouch tech or standing tech, you're screwed, basically.
If you do crouch tech at the fastest timing, and if it's a 3 frame move, like say Dictator's crouch light kick, it will come out just before, but it has to be really quick. Like frame. But if you do that, you lose to the fastest light punch.
And see, that's why characters, for example, let's say DJ, for my character, he has no 3 frame moves.
Oh, GG.
Yeah, exactly. My fastest crouching move is 4 frames, and that's a light punch. So my crouch tech is actually 5 frames, which is my crouching light kick. So basically, I'm screwed. The only thing I can do is block and pray that he doesn't do EX command grab, and then I can tech his normal grab. Because I can't press any normals, because I lose. 3 frames beat my 4 and 5.
Yeah. And say, like, this is what I saw in NSV, just recent, the most recent NSV.
Momochi won with Yun.
Yeah, what Kindeva did, right? EX lunge punch against Chun-Li, okay? Against Y24, the best Chun-Li in Nagoya, who used to beat me 8-2 in vanilla.
Damn.
He blocked lunge punch, right? EX lunge punch. And what Kindeva did was crouch light punch, EX lunge punch. And EX, that second one, is a crouch tech breaker. And he will even kill backstep.
Back
kill
back
any, I mean,
anything.
Yeah. And he ate it. Kindeva did ultra. game over.
Or the second lunge punch will push you right into the corner, and then you're stuffed anyway.
Yeah. So
that's 2 meters. But the thing is, they build meters so quickly.
Yes, exactly.
They can just keep doing it.
So it's like, I see. Well, and then
Kinebu, super turbo for me.
And then Kinebu.
And then okay, in Japanese, kusoge means kuso means shit.
Mm-hmm.
Ge is the short form for game.
Mm-hmm.
So kusoge means like a shit game. Like, you know, this is broken. It's like, you know, the game is broken.
Yeah.
And everyone said that. Even the commentator, Gama no Abura, the NSB, you know, organizer, he said that.
Yeah.
And what Kinebu said in reply to that was, this is the way how the game is designed.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And it, you know, it's just, this is the way it is made. So you can't really, you know, complain. If you're going to complain, might as well use Yun.
It's perfectly legal within the game rules.
Mm.
But some people just can't accept it. And I understand.
Mm.
But I just play. And this is what I've always believed. At the point when you decide to play a game, you're not forced to pick a particular character. No one's pointing a gun at you and telling you to choose Ryu or choose Juri or choose, you know, Haken.
But I did choose Haken.
It's your choice. I don't understand why people complain when it's your choice, absolutely, to choose a character at your own free will and you lose and you complain the opponent's character.
Oh, but what if you choose a character of your own free will and you enjoy using him, but he gets nerfed in every edition of the game?
Well, if you love it so much, then you shouldn't, you know.
Mm.
I mean, I have a friend in Japan who continues to use Blanca and he complains all the time to me because we're really good friends, right? And I'm like, oh shit, I'm going to switch to another character. I'm going to switch to you. And I'm going to switch. But he still plays Blanca in his master.
Mm.
And he, you know, people give credit to him.
Mm.
Right?
But some of the enjoyment is lost because, like, you know, let's say the Gen players in Super who, you know, do the medium kick hands, they spend so much time mastering it and then it's taken away in...
Medium kick hands.
Sorry, from Vanilla to Super.
From Vanilla to Super, sorry. You know Gen, the character, he does
Gen,
medium kick hands, the loop.
Really?
Yeah. And then they took it out in Super and then, like... Yeah,
it took some people, you know, a good 5 to 6 months to master the loop.
And then
it was removed. The next version.
Their main offensive strategy. And then some people say, fuck, this is like a completely different character. I'm just going to not play.
Then don't play. That's my answer.
Then it's horrible, right?
Why?
Because it's like...
Because you invested a certain amount of time into a character which you enjoyed playing.
Mm.
And you want to continue playing that character because you enjoy the character. You like the character design. You like the character, the way they work, and so forth. But because... You know, the Capcom gods decided that this character has either this or doesn't need this, then you basically cannot enjoy the character to that certain level of what they could. Or it just changes the game to such a different level that it's that character is not the same anymore. And I understand what you're going to say is, well, then just change character because it's not the same. I understand that, but it's sort of, to a certain point, it's like a loyalty factor.
Mm.
Where you invested so much time into something,
then
it's basically taken away. It's like, okay, let me put it this way. Say you're building a house, right? And you invest $100,000 into that house. And then the government comes along and says, sorry, you're going to lose that house because we're going to build a highway.
Mm.
And there's nothing you can do. That's basically sort of that feeling.
Mm.
It's like you invested so much time, and then it's just taken away.
Then I have one question. People who divorce, do they never remarry? They invest so much time and effort into relationship, yet it's screwed up. They decide to walk the separate path. They'll come back. I mean, not come back, but they will, you know, gather strength to try to enter another relationship. It's the same thing. And the thing is, I think it comes to definition of love.
Mm-hmm.
You love that person or that character for who it is. Who she is, who he is, right? Yeah. And if that, I mean, it's totally absurd to compare games to, you know, relationship, but nothing remains the same forever.
That's true.
They change.
Mm.
And sometimes you accept the change, sometimes you can't. When you can't accept the change, you have no choice but to leave for your own good.
Exactly.
Mm.
And I think it's just a game, so maybe I'm talking too serious. But
to some people, it's not.
For some people, it's much more than that. It gets to that point where some people, it's much more than just a game.
Then you should play the old version.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's what you have. Super Turbo, HD Remix. People still play Super Turbo because they don't like HD Remix.
That's why I played Vanilla even after console release, because I like to, you know, play in the arcade, and I didn't really, you know, buy console or anything. People recommended me and I didn't. And maybe that's partly why I didn't do well in the BAM or something. But I accepted it because, like, I mean, of course I felt really bad for like, say, Toxie and the others, like Sol and who did well in, you know, 5-on-5 and had me as the last. And like, I didn't even prepare. So I let them down, and I owe an apology to them. But like, you know, I just didn't have the love, I suppose. And you can't really, you know, have everything in your way. Life is full of, you know, shit's happening. So you have to accept it, I guess. So if you really can't stand Yoon, rather than bitching, the mature attitude or approach would be to actually keep it quiet and enjoy the game as much as you can, or just not play.
Okay.
Because like some people enjoy, what's it called? Marvel versus
Capcom 3.
Yeah.
But see, personally, I love that game.
Personally,
that's good.
I hate it.
Okay, all right. But I mean, I've never played it. And like, I don't intend to play, but like, you know, it's fun to watch because like someone pressing one button and looks like the same move again and again, and like Mutton just died, like, you know, before the interview, and then you say, I just had 50k, and I had no idea what that 50k referred to, but like he just died, and like, you know, for me it's interesting to watch, but obviously players who are playing themselves won't find it fun.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
But to switch text again, sorry. You're going to be on Bomb's team for Shadow Showdown, right? You, Gensa, and Bomb, right?
How did you get that information?
Bomb to us.
Oh, did he?
On the interview. It's going to be on the interview, so everyone will know. So are you going to be doing like some training for Shadow Showdown?
Yeah, of course.
You're going to be
prepared? It was actually Bomb who asked me through Henry. So I guess I have to, you know.
Really train. You suck at.
I suppose, yeah.
Because Gensa is using, Henry is using Yun and Bomb using Yang, so you have to play suck at.
No, well, I know my job. My job is to get rid of Yun and Yang. No, I'm serious.
Yeah.
That is the, you know, team strategy. I mean, Bomb wanted me to, and I don't think I can beat Kindevu. Sorry, Bomb. Because I played in Japan, it was 19-0, if I remember correctly.
Damn.
19-0.
So wait, did you play Daigo too?
No, because I told you.
Oh, you're only in the Nagoya.
I played Momochi's Cody.
Yeah.
And for his, you know, honor, I wouldn't say the result.
Yeah.
But I didn't go bad.
Oh.
But it was only one match. So and Cody Sagat is in favor of Sagat.
Sagat, yes. But not Sagat Yun.
Sagat Yun is even.
Even. Oh.
Yeah.
So that's why, I mean, and I didn't play. Did I play his Yun? Maybe once. I mean, Momochi's Yun. Maybe once. I said Momochi and Kindevu's Yun. I didn't beat. Bamba Ban, who is about 105,000 BP now, who was in the NSB just last one, who made it to top 8. I played him and I think I won about 3 or 4 out of 10 or something. So, the very first time I played against him, my friend is a good friend of him, and he said to me that, oh, Bamba Ban said, you know how to fight against Yun. And I said, oh, this is my like second or third time. Like I'm really honored. But yeah, well, my job is to sort of beat the twins.
Beat the twins for Bomb and
yeah, well, because I have so many bad matchups.
And they beat everybody else, basically.
They beat Sim, they beat, who else is Sagat's bet? Did they beat Fei Long? Or did they do well against Fei Long?
Fei Long's even, I think.
Also, even's better than the bad matchup for
Sagat. Well, Fei Long's Sagat is about 6.5. Minimum 6.4 in favor of Fei Long. And Dao Sim is also hard. And who else? Akuma is okay.
Akuma, yeah.
Akuma is okay. But
Yun rapes Akuma, right? Yeah, so there's a
Dudley.
Oh, Dali.
Dali is one of the worst matchups of Sagat.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah, because of EX ducking and ducking. Everything. And Ultra One.
Yes. I can't Tiger Shot unless it's full screen.
Mm.
My standing heavy kick, I can't use. A, because I lose the jump heavy kick.
Yeah, and the other thing is it does massive damage.
And standing heavy kick, option select, my heavy standing heavy kick will lose.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's a really bad matchup. So I have a few bad matchups, but it should be, you know.
But it's an interesting team. It looks like, you know, at least someone has a plan to take down some of the internationals at Shadow Showdown.
Well, I don't know what kind of teams are already confirmed from like overseas. I mean, like I know who's coming, but I don't know who's teaming up with who.
Yeah. Oh, so, but what about Third Strike? Are you entering Third Strike?
I can tell you one thing. Daigo and
Mago will be on the same team.
Daigo, Mago, Tokido. That's it. Choco, Kindebu, Momochi.
GG Australia.
Yeah, well, I'll still try my best.
Of course.
How about Third Strike?
Yeah, Third Strike. Are you entering Third Strike? So what do you think of your chances again in Third Strike? Like?
Zero. Okay, I tell you this.
Have you played Deshikan in MOV before?
MOV,
yeah.
I can never beat.
Yeah.
He is not human.
Not human.
Wow.
Yeah. I talked to Umezono in person over the phone about 3 weeks ago, something like that.
Mm.
I said, I'm betting on you. I'm hoping that you have a chance against MOV. Oh, no.
Yeah,
no, no one can beat MOV.
What about Kuroda?
Possible, but Kuroda doesn't like Chun-Li, so he might not want to. I mean, Kuroda is not coming, besides.
Yeah, but okay.
I've heard similar reports that MOV is technically unbeatable to a certain point when people do not want to play.
Is he unbeatable or just the best Chun?
Almost to a point it's unbeatable.
Because he's the best Chun. Something like that.
He is the best Chun, and Chun is the best character. The best character.
But then people think Kuroda is the best because he can play a lot of characters his own style. Something like that.
But okay, put it this way. Kuroda absolutely hates Chun-Li as far as I know. And I don't think he respects Chun-Li players in general, except for one or two.
MOV.
And that's MOV, I believe. Okay. Otherwise, why would he team up with MOV?
So what about Deshikan? How do you think?
I think Deshikan retired a long time ago. He hasn't played for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I know that every year they have this like big tournament in Kyushu. And like say Kokujin and all the famous players, they travel all the way to Kyushu. So it's like sort of like reunion kind of a thing as well. But I think Deshikan hasn't been entering SBO or anything for the past couple of years. I'm just counting on Umezono. He's my mentor.
He's your mentor. But yeah, I mean, we recently saw MOV in Europe, right? Playing Street Fighter 4 and doing really well. So,
Rose?
Playing Ken. Ken, right? Yeah.
Well, my prediction in Third Strike is that not a chance for Cyrus. That's for sure.
What about Nick?
What about Nick?
Sorry, Nick.
Well, see, it was an interesting thing because Henry told me that he's going to take Third Strike.
Yeah,
what did he say about Last Bam?
Yeah, I heard a similar thing as well.
Last Bam, he said, oh, Akira is free. Akira is gay and free.
Yeah.
And I did beat him. And I hadn't played for a long, long time back then. But I still, maybe he was a bit nervous. Hope he will be able to redeem himself. We'll see how it goes. But when it comes to Third Strike, I have a very competitive mind, so I don't even want to lose to the coach.
Oh,
interesting.
So yeah, is there anything else you want to talk about? Like just
any shout outs?
Yeah, we've talked about the Japanese community, your history, Shadow Showdown, and the community and Arcade Edition. So anything else you want to talk about? The future?
I think, you know, you guys are really lucky to have the community you do.
We are. We are really lucky to be in Melbourne.
Of course, you two have put a lot of effort in.
Other people have done way more.
Mean, of course, but I mean, you two have certain part, you know, to contribute. So it's really good, you know, and I hope that the community will continue to grow and, you know, they will need you guys on top of the others. So, and I'm happy to just, you know, put pieces and bits in whenever I can. Yeah. Just as long as it's not gonna, you know, sort of like get in my other priority.
Yeah, that's understandable. So,
yeah. That's understandable. So, yeah. So, any shout-outs to anybody you want to give?
Well, thanks for, you know, having me as an interviewee. Yeah,
it's our pleasure.
I'm actually really glad we got around to doing this before Shadaloo Showdown as well, because your name was actually in one of the trailers. And I wanted to interview you because not too many people outside of Australia actually know who you are.
Mm.
But given through this interview and, you know, your history of even going to SBO and whatnot, I think it's actually really good to show that Australia does have
international caliber player.
Exactly.
Yeah, like Toxie has been an evil, Bomb has been to Hong Kong to eat food with Gamer B.
Exactly. So we do have the potential to actually be good.
Mm.
And I think the rest of Australia is slowly getting around to it.
Mm.
It's a natural slow process. It's similar to evolution, you know. Over millions of years, we finally got somewhere. Well, we're trying to speed that up a little. Hopefully in the next 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
We're on the right track. I mean, I'm not in a place to say, but everyone's doing great, you know, in terms of support we get in a lot. And I'm quite happy to see. I mean, because I was originally involved heavily in Search Strike community.
Mm-hmm.
And one stage I was even like one of two or three Melbourne moderator because Kevin and like Locke weren't doing much because they were too busy with other stuff. And for me, I've always wanted the community to grow and to see how far you guys have come. I mean, I'm just an old retired fart, but really happy to see that. And yeah, so awesome. Props to everyone who's involved.
Okay, awesome. So
yeah, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Akira. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Excessum from The X Report and Shadaloo.com. Keep listening to Being a...
You're listening to Don't Be a Scrub Podcast.
All right, cut it out. You're listening to Don't Be a Scrub Podcast.
Stay hungry, stay salty.
Stay hungry, stay salty. And continue listening.
It's going to be a lot of editing work.
Yeah!
Once again, we'd like to thank Akira for sitting down and doing the interview with us. I think that's going to wrap it up for episode 13 of Don't Be a Scrub Podcast. As always, stay hungry, stay salty, and thank you for listening.